a hippie waist.
I'm going to put these cuffs on him, Mr. Sharpton says to Skipper. If he gives me any trouble, run him over with a shopping cart.
Totally eventual, Skipper says. And I wake up half out of my bed and on the floor, screaming. 15. Then about 10 days after I moved in, I had another kind of dream. I don't remember what it was, but it must have been a good one because when I woke up, I was smiling. I could feel it on my face, a big, happy smile. It was like when I woke up with the idea about Mrs. Bukowski's dog, almost exactly like that. I pulled on a pair of jeans and went into the study. I turned on the computer and opened the window marked Tools. There's a program in there called Dinky's Notebook. I went right to it and all my symbols were there. Circles, triangles, chaps, mercs, rhomboids, bues, smims, fouders, hundreds more, thousands more, maybe millions more. It's sort of like Mr. Sharpton said, a new world, and I'm on the coastline of the first continent. All I know is that all at once it was there for me. I had a great big Macintosh computer to work with instead of a little piece of pink chalk, and all I had to do was type the words for the symbols and the symbols would appear. I was jacked to the max. I mean, my God! It was like a river of fire burning in the middle of my head. I wrote, I called up symbols, I used the mouse to drag everything where it was supposed to be. And when it was done, I had a letter. One of the special letters. But a letter to who? A letter to where? Then I realized it didn't matter. Make a few minor customizing touches, and there were many people the letter could go to. Although this one had been written for a man rather than a woman. I don't know how I knew that, I just did. I decided to start with Cincinnati, only because Cincinnati was the first city to come into my mind. It could as easily have been Zurich, Switzerland, or Waterville, Maine. I tried to open a Tools program titled Dinky Mail. Before the computer would let me in there, it prompted me to wake up my modem. Once the modem was running, the computer wanted a 312 area code. 312 Chicago, and I imagine that, as far as the phone company is concerned, my CompuCalls all come from TransCorp's headquarters. I didn't care one way or another. That was their business. I had found my business and was taking care of it. With the modem awake and linked to Chicago, the computer flashed Dinky Mail ready. I clicked on Locale. I'd been in the study almost 3 hours by then, with only one break to take a quick piss, and I could smell myself, sweating and stinking like a monkey in a greenhouse. I didn't mind. I liked the smell. I was having the time of my life. I was fucking delirious. I typed Cincinnati and hit execute. No listing Cincinnati, the computer said. Okay, not a problem. Try Columbus, closer to home anyway. And yes, folks, we have a bingo. Two listings Columbus. There were two telephone numbers. I clicked on the top one, curious and a little afraid of what might pop out. But it wasn't a dossier or a profile or, God forbid, a photograph. There was one single word. Muffin. Say what? But then I knew. Muffin was Mr. Columbus's pet. Very likely a cat. I called up my special letter again, transposed two symbols, and deleted a third. Then I added Muffin to the top with an arrow pointing down. There. Perfect. Did I wonder who Muffin's owner was, or what he had done to warrant TransCorp's attention, or exactly what was going to happen to him? I did not. The idea that my conditioning at Peoria might have been partially responsible for this disinterest never crossed my mind either. I was doing my thing, that was all. Just doing my thing and as happy as a clam at high tide. I called the number on the screen. I had the computer speaker on, but there was no hello, only the screechy mating call of another computer. Just as well, really. Life's easier when you subtract the human element. Then it's like that movie, 12 o'clock high, cruising over Berlin in your trusty B-52, looking through your trusty Norden bomb sight and waiting for just the right moment to push your trusty button. You might see smokestacks or factory roofs, but no people. The guys who dropped the bombs from their B-52s didn't have to hear the screams of mothers whose children had just been reduced to guts. And I didn't even have to hear anyone say hello. A very good deal. After a little bit, I turned off the speaker anyway. I found it distracting. Modem found, the computer flashed, and then search for email address Y/N. I typed Y and waited. This time the wait was longer. I think the computer was going back to Chicago again and getting what it needed to unlock the email address of Mr. Columbus. Still, it was less than 30 seconds before the computer is right back at me with email address found. Send dinky mail Y/N. I typed Y with absolutely no hesitation. The computer flashed, sending dinky mail, and then dinky mail sent. That was all. No fireworks. I wonder what happened to Muffin, though. You know, after. 16. That night I called Mr. Sharpton and said, "I'm working."
"That's good, Dink. Great news. Feel better?"
Calm as ever. Mr. Sharpton is like the weather in Tahiti. "Yeah," I said. The fact was, I felt blissful. It was the best day of my life. Doubts or no doubts, worries or no worries, I still say that. The most eventual day of my life. It was like a river of fire in my head. A fucking river of fire, can you get that? "Do you feel better, Mr. Sharpton? Relieved?"
"I'm happy for you, but I can't say I'm relieved, because you were never worried in the first place."
"Got it in one," he said. "Everything's eventual, in other words." He laughed at that. He always laughs when I say that.
"That's right, Dink. Everything's eventual."
"Mr. Sharpton?"
"Yes?"
"Email's not exactly private, you know. Anybody who's really dedicated can hack into it."
"Part of what you send is a suggestion that the recipient delete the message from all files, is it not?"
"Yes, but I can't absolutely guarantee that I'll do it, or she."
"Even if they don't, nothing can happen to someone else who chances on such a message, am I correct? Because it's personalized."
"Well, it might give someone a headache, but that would be about all."
"And the communication itself would look like so much gibberish."
"Or a code." He laughed heartily at that.
"Let them try to break it, Dinky, eh? Just let them try."
I sighed. "I suppose."
"Let's discuss something more important, Dink. How did it feel?"
"Fucking wonderful."
"Good. Don't question wonder, Dink. Don't ever question wonder."
And he hung up. 17. Sometimes I have to send actual letters. Print out the stuff I womp up in Dinky's notebook, stick it in an envelope, lick stamps, and mail it off to somebody somewhere. Professor Ann Tevich, University of New Mexico at Las Cruces. Mr. Andrew Neff, care of the New York Post, New York, New York. Billy Younger, General Delivery, Stovington, Vermont. Only names, but they were still more upsetting than the phone numbers. More personal than the phone numbers. It was like seeing faces swim up at you for a second inside your Norden bomb sight. I mean, what a freak out, right? You're up there at 25,000 feet, no faces allowed up there, but sometimes one shows up for a second or two just the same. I wondered how a university professor could get along without a modem, or a guy whose address was a fucking New York newspaper for that matter. But I never wondered too much. I didn't have to. We live in a modern world, but letters don't have to be sent by computer after all. There's still snail mail, and the stuff I really needed was always in the database. The fact that Unger had a 1957 Thunderbird, for instance, or that Ann Tevich had a loved one, perhaps her husband, perhaps her son, perhaps her father, named Simon.
and people like Tevich and Unger were exceptions. Most of the folks I reach out and touch are like that first one in Columbus, fully equipped for the 21st century. Sending dinky mail sent. Very good. So long, Charlie. I could have gone on like that for a long time, maybe forever, browsing the database. There's no schedule to follow, no list of primary cities and targets. I'm completely on my own, unless all that shit is also in my subconscious, down there on the hard disk. Going to afternoon movies, enjoying the ma-less silence of my little house, and dreaming of my next step up the ladder. Except I woke up feeling horny one day. I worked for an hour or so browsing around in Australia, but it was no good. My dick kept trespassing on my brain, so to speak. I shut off the computer and went down to News Plus to see if I could find a magazine featuring pretty ladies and frothy lingerie. As I got there, a guy was coming out reading the Columbus Dispatch. I never read the paper myself. Why bother? It's the same old shit day in and day out. Dictators beating the ching-chong out of people weaker than they are. Men in uniforms beating the ching-chong out of soccer balls or footballs. Politicians kissing babies and kissing ass. Mostly stories about the Skipper Brannigans of the world, in other words. And I wouldn't have seen this story even if I'd happened to look at the newspaper display rack once I got inside, because it was on the bottom half of the front page, below the fold. But this fucking dimbulb comes out with the paper hanging open and his face buried inside it. In the lower right corner was a picture of a white-haired guy smoking a pipe and smiling. He looked like a good-humored fuck, probably Irish, eyes all crinkled up and these white bushy eyebrows. And the headline over the photo, not a big one but you could read it, said, "Neff suicide still puzzles, grieves colleagues." For a second or two I thought I'd just skip News Plus that day. I didn't feel like ladies in lingerie after all. Maybe I'd just go home and take a nap. If I went in, I'd probably pick up a copy of the Dispatch. Wouldn't be able to help myself, and I wasn't sure I wanted to know any more about that Irish-looking guy than I already did. Which was nothing at all, as you can fucking believe, I hastened to tell myself. Neff couldn't be that weird a name anyway. Only four letters. Not like Shittin' Dukas or Whorecake. There must be thousands of Neffs if you're talking coast to coast. This one didn't have to be the Neff I knew about. The one who loved Frank Sinatra records. It would be better, in any case, to just leave and come back tomorrow. Tomorrow, the picture of that guy with the pipe would be gone. Tomorrow, somebody else's picture would be there on the lower right corner of page one. People are always dying, right? People who aren't superstars or anything. Just famous enough to get their pictures down there in the lower right corner of page one. And sometimes people were puzzled about it, the way folks back home in Harkerville had been puzzled about Skipper's death. No alcohol in his blood. Clear night, dry road, not the suicidal type. The world is full of mysteries like that, though, and sometimes it's best not to solve them. Sometimes the solutions aren't, you know, too eventual. But willpower has never been my strong point. I can't always keep away from the chocolate, even though I know my skin doesn't like it, and I couldn't keep away from the Columbus Dispatch that day. I went on inside and bought one. I started home, then had a funny thought. The funny thought was that I didn't want a newspaper with Andrew Neff's picture on the front page going out with my trash. The trash pickup guys came in a city truck. Surely they couldn't have anything to do with TransCorp, but... There was a show me and Pug used to watch one summer back when we were little kids. Golden Years, it was called. You probably don't remember it. Anyway, there was a guy on that show who used to say, "Perfect paranoia is perfect awareness." It was like his motto. And I sort of believe that. Anyway, I went to the park instead of back home. I sat on a bench and read the story, and when I was done, I stuck the paper in a park trash barrel. I didn't even like doing that, but hey, if Mr. Sharpton has got a guy following me around and checking on every little thing I throw away, I'm fucked up the wazoo no matter what. There was no doubt that Andrew Neff, age 62, a columnist for the New York Post since 1970, had committed suicide. He took a bunch of pills that probably would have done the trick, then climbed into his bathtub, put a plastic bag over his head, and rounded the evening off by slitting his wrists. There was a man totally dedicated to avoiding counseling. He left no note, though, and the autopsy showed no signs of disease. His colleagues scoffed at the idea of Alzheimer's or even early senility. He was the sharpest guy I've ever known right up to the day he died, a guy named Pete Hamill said. He could have gone on Challenge Jeopardy and run both boards. I have no idea why Andy did such a thing. Hamill went on to say that one of Neff's charming oddities was his complete refusal to participate in the computer revolution. No modems for him, no laptop word processor, no handheld spell checker from Franklin Electronic Publishers. He didn't even have a CD player in his apartment, Hamill said. Neff claimed, perhaps only half-joking, that compact discs were the devil's work. He loved the chairman of the board, but only on vinyl. This guy Hamill and several others said Neff was unfailingly cheerful, right up to the afternoon he filed his last column, went home, drank a glass of wine, and then demoed himself. One of the Post's chatter columnists, Liz Smith, said she'd shared a piece of pie with him just before he left on that last day, and Neff had seemed a trifle distracted, but otherwise fine. Distracted, sure. With a head full of Fouders, Bues, and Smims, you'd be distracted, too. Neff, the piece went on, had been something of an anomaly on the Post, which sticks up for the more conservative view of life. I guess they don't come right out and recommend electrocuting welfare recipients after 3 years and still no job, but they do hint that it's always an option. I guess Neff was the House liberal. He wrote a column called Enough is Enough, and in it he talked about changing the way New York treated single teen mothers, suggested that maybe abortion wasn't always murder, argued that the low-income housing in the outer boroughs was a self-perpetuating hate machine. Near the end of his life, he'd been writing columns about the size of the military and asking why we as a country felt we had to keep pouring on the bucks when there was, essentially, no one left to fight except for the terrorists. He said we'd do better to spend that money creating jobs. And Post readers, who would have crucified anyone else saying stuff like that, pretty much loved it when Neff laid it down. Because he was funny, because he was charming. Maybe because he was Irish and had kissed the Blarney Stone. That was about all. I started home. Somewhere along the way I took a detour, though, and ended up walking all over downtown. I zigged and zagged, walking down boulevards and cutting through parking lots, all the time thinking about Andrew Neff climbing into his bathtub and putting a baggie over his head. A big one, a gallon size, keeps all your leftovers supermarket fresh. He was funny, he was charming, and I had killed him. Neff had opened my letter and it had gotten into his head somehow. Judging by what I'd read in the paper, the special words and symbols took maybe 3 days to fuck him up enough to swallow the pills and climb into the tub. He deserved it. That's what Mr. Sharpton said about Skipper, and maybe he was right. That time. But did Neff deserve it? Was there shit about him I didn't know? Did he maybe like little girls in the wrong way, or push dope, or go after people too weak to fight back? Like Skipper had gone after me with the shopping cart. We want to help you use your talent for the betterment of all mankind, Mr. Sharpton said. And surely that didn't mean making a guy off himself because he thought the Defense Department was spending too much money on smart bombs. Paranoid shit like that is strictly for movies starring Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme. Then I had a bad idea. A scary idea. Maybe Transcorp didn't want him dead because he wrote that stuff. Maybe they wanted him dead because people, the wrong people, were starting to think about what he wrote. That's crazy, I said right out loud. And a woman looking into the window of Columbia City, oh so pretty, turned around and gave me the old fish eye. I ended up at the public library around 2 o'clock with my legs aching and my head throbbing. I kept seeing that guy in the bathtub with his wrinkled old man's tits and white chest hair, his nice smile gone, replaced by this vague Planet X look. I kept seeing him putting a baggie over his head, humming a Sinatra tune, My Way, maybe,
as he snugged it down tight, then peered through it the way you'd peer through a cloudy window, so he could see to slit the veins in his wrists. I didn't want to see that stuff, but I couldn't stop. My bomb sight had turned into a telescope. They had a computer room in the library, and you could get on the internet at a very reasonable cost. I had to get a library card, too, but that was okay. A library card is good to have. You can never have too much ID. It took me only $3 worth of time to find Ann Tevich and call up the report of her death. The story started, I saw the sinking sensation, in the bottom right-hand corner of page 1, the official dead folks nook, and then jumped to the obituary page. Professor Tevich had been a pretty lady, blonde, 37. In the photo, she was holding her glasses in her hand, as if she wanted people to know she wore them, but as if she'd wanted people to see what pretty eyes she had, too. That made me feel sad and guilty. Her death was startlingly like Skipper's. Coming home from her office at UNM just after dark, maybe hurrying a little because it was her turn to make supper, but what the hell? Good driving conditions and great visibility. Her car, vanity license plate DNA fan, I happen to know, had veered off the road, overturned, and landed in a dry wash. She was still alive when someone spotted the headlights and found her, but there had never been any real hope. Her injuries were too grave. There was no alcohol in her system, and her marriage was in good shape. No kids, at least, thank God for small favors. So the idea of suicide was far-fetched. She had been looking forward to the future. She even talked about getting a computer to celebrate a new research grant. She'd refused to own a PC since 1988 or so, had lost some valuable data in one when it locked up, and had distrusted them ever since. She would use her department's equipment when she absolutely had to, but that was all. The coroner's verdict had been accidental death. Professor Ann Tevich, a clinical biologist, had been in the forefront of West Coast AIDS research. Another scientist, this one in California, said that her death might set back the search for a cure 5 years. She was a key player, he said. Smart, yes, but more. I once heard someone refer to her as a natural-born facilitator, and that's as good a description as any. Anne was the kind of person who holds other people together. Her death is a great loss to the dozens of people who knew and loved her, but it's an even greater loss to this cause. Billy Unger was also easy enough to find. His picture topped page 1 of the Stovington Weekly Current, instead of getting stuck down there in the dead folks' nook, but that might have been because there weren't many famous people in Stovington. Unger had been General William Rollum Unger, winner of the Silver Star and Bronze Star in Korea. During the Kennedy administration, he was an Undersecretary of Defense, Acquisition Reform, and one of the really big war hawks of that time. Kill the Ruskies, drink their blood, keep America safe for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, that sort of thing. Then, around the time Lyndon Johnson was escalating the war in Vietnam, Billy Unger had a change of mind and heart. He began writing letters to newspapers. He started his op-ed page career by saying that we were handling the war wrong. He progressed to the idea that we were wrong to be in Vietnam at all. Then around 1975 or so, he got to the point of saying all wars were wrong. That was okay with most Vermonters. He served 7 terms in the state legislature, starting in 1978 when a group of progressive Democrats asked him to run for the U.S. Senate in 1996. He said he wanted to do some reading and consider his options. The implication was that he would be ready for a national career in politics by 2002 at the latest. He was getting old, but Vermonters like old guys, I guess. 1996 went past without Unger declaring himself a candidate for anything, possibly because his wife died of cancer. And before 2002 came around, he bought himself a big old dirt sandwich and ate every bite. There's a small but loyal contingent in Stovington which claimed Rollum's death was an accident, that Silver Star winners don't jump off their roofs, even if they have lost a wife to cancer in the last year or so. But the rest pointed out that the guy probably hadn't been repairing the shingles. Not in his nightshirt, not at 2 o'clock in the morning. Suicide was the verdict. Yeah, right. Kiss my ass and go to heaven.
18. I left the library and thought I'd head home. Instead, I went back to the same park bench again. I sat there until the sun was low and the place had pretty much emptied out of kids and frisbee-catching dogs. And although I'd been in Columbia City for 3 months by then, it was the latest I'd ever been out. That's sad, I guess. I thought I was living a life here, finally getting away from Ma and living a life, but all I've been doing is throwing a shadow. If people, certain people, were checking up on me, they might wonder why the change in routine. So I got up, went on home, boiled up a bag of that shit on a shingle stuff, and turned on my TV. I've got cable, the full package, including premium movie channels, and I've never seen a single bill. How's that for an eventual deal? I turned on Cinemax. Rutger Hauer was playing a blind karate fighter. I sat down on the couch beneath my fake Rembrandt and watched the show. I didn't see it, but I ate my chow and looked at it. I thought about stuff. About a newspaper columnist who had liberal ideas and a conservative readership. About an AIDS researcher who served an important linking function with other AIDS researchers. About an old general who changed his mind. I thought about the fact that I only knew these three by name because they didn't have modems and email capability. There was other stuff to think about, too. Like how you could hypnotize a talented guy or drug him, or maybe even expose him to other talented guys in order to keep him from asking any of the wrong questions or doing any of the wrong things. Like how you could make sure such a talented guy couldn't run away even if he happened to wake up to the truth. You do that by setting him up in what was, essentially, a cashless existence. A life where rule number one was no rat-holing any extra dough, not even pocket change. What sort of talented guy would fall for something like that? A naive one, with few friends and next to no self-image. A guy who would sell you his talented soul for a few groceries and 70 bucks a week because he believes that's about what it's worth. I didn't want to think about any of that. I tried to concentrate on Rutger Hauer, doing all that amusing blind karate shit. Pug would have laughed his ass off if he'd been there, believe me. So I wouldn't have to think about any of that. 200, for instance. There was a number I didn't want to think about. 200. 10 times 20, 40 times 5, CC to the old Romans. At least 200 times I'd push the button that brought the message Dinky Mail Sent up on my screen. It occurred to me, for the first time as if I was finally waking up, that I was a murderer. A mass murderer. Yes, indeed, that's what it comes down to. Good of mankind, bad of mankind, indifferent of mankind, who makes those judgments, Mr. Sharpton? His bosses, their bosses, and does it matter? I decided it didn't matter a fuck in a rabbit hutch. I further decided I really couldn't spend too much time moaning, even to myself, how I had been drugged, hypnotized, or exposed to some kind of mind control. The truth was, I'd been doing what I was doing because I loved the feeling I got when I was composing the special letters. The feeling that there was a river of fire running through the center of my head. Mostly, I'd been doing it because I could. That's not true, I said, but not real loud. I whispered it under my breath. They probably don't have any bugs planted here. I'm sure they don't, but it's best to be safe. I started writing this, what is it? A report, maybe. I started writing this report later that night, as soon as the Rutger Hauer movie was over, in fact. I write in a notebook, though, not on my computer. And I write in plain old English, no sankophytes, no bews, no smims. There's a loose floor tile under the ping-pong table down in the basement. That's where I keep my report. I just now look back at how I started. I've got a good job now, I wrote, and no reason to feel glum. Idiotic. But of course, any fool who can pucker is apt to whistle past the graveyard. When I went to bed that night, I dreamed I was in the parking lot of the Super Saver. Pug was there wearing his red duster and a hat on his head like the one Mickey Mouse wore in Fantasia. That's the movie where Mickey played the sorcerer's apprentice. Halfway across the parking lot, shopping carts were lined up in a row. Pug would raise his hand, then lower it. Each time he did this, a cart would start rolling by itself, gathering speed, rushing across the lot until it crashed into the brick side of the supermarket. They were piling up there, a glittering junk heap of metal and wheels. For once in his life, Pug wasn't smiling. I wanted to ask him what he was doing and what it meant, but of course I knew. "He's been good to me," I told Pug in this dream. It was Mr. Sharpton I meant, of course. "He's been really, really eventual." Pug turned fully to me then, and I saw it wasn't Pug at all. It was Skipper, and his head had been smashed in all the way down to the eyebrows. Shattered hunks of skull stuck up in a circle, making him look like he was wearing a bone crown. "You're not looking through a bomb sight," Skipper said and grinned. "You are the bomb sight. How do you like that, Dinkster?" I woke up in the dark of my room, sweating, with my hands over my mouth to hold in a scream. So I guess I didn't like it very much. 19. Writing this has been a sad education, let me tell you. It's like, "Hey, Dink, welcome to the real world." Mostly it's the image of grinding up dollar bills in the kitchen pig that comes to me when I think about what has happened to me. But I know that's only because it's easier to think of grinding up money or chucking it into the storm drain than it is to think about grinding up people. Sometimes I hate myself. Sometimes I'm scared for my immortal soul, if I have one. And sometimes I'm just embarrassed. "Trust me," Mr. Sharpton said, and I did. I mean, duh. How dumb can you get? I tell myself I'm just a kid, the same age as the kids who crewed those B-52s I sometimes think about, that kids are allowed to be dumb, but I wonder if that's true when lives are at stake. And of course, I'm still doing it. Yes. I thought at first that I wouldn't be able to, no more than the kids in Mary Poppins could keep floating around the house when they lost their happy thoughts, but I could. And once I sat down in front of the computer screen and that river of fire started to flow, I was lost. You see, at least I think you do, this is what I was put on planet Earth for. Can I be blamed for doing the thing that finishes me off, that completes me? Answer, yes. Absolutely. But I can't stop. Sometimes I tell myself that I've gone on because if I do stop, maybe even for a day, they'll know I've caught on. And the cleaners will make an unscheduled stop. Except what they'll clean up this time will be me. But that's not why. I do it because I'm just another addict. Same as a guy smoking crack in an alley or some chick taking a spike in her arm. I do it because of the hateful fucking rush. I do it because when I'm working in Dinky's notebook, everything's eventual. It's like being caught in a candy trap. And it's all the fault of that dork who came out of News Plus with his fucking dispatch open. If not for him, I'd still see nothing but cloud-hazy buildings in the crosshairs. No people, just targets. "You are the bomb site," Skipper said in my dream. "You are the bomb site, Dinkster." That's true. I know it is. Horrible, but true. I'm just another tool. Just the lens the real bombardier looks through. Just the button he pushes. What bombardier, you ask? Oh, come on, get real. I thought of calling him. How's that for crazy? Or maybe it's not.
"Call me any time, Dink. Even 3 in the morning.
That's what the man said, and I'm pretty sure that's what the man meant. About that, at least Mr. Sharpton wasn't lying. I thought of calling him and saying, "You want to know what hurts the most, Mr. Sharpton? That thing you said about how I could make the world a better place by getting rid of people like Skipper. The truth is, you're the guys like Skipper." Sure, and on the shopping cart they chase people with, laughing and barking and making race car sounds. I work cheap, too, at bargain basement rates. So far I've killed over 200 people, and what did it cost Transcorp? A little house in a third-rate Ohio town, $70 a week, and a Honda automobile, plus cable TV. Don't want to forget that. I stood there for a while looking at the telephone, then put it down again. Couldn't say any of that. It would be the same as putting a baggie over my head and then slitting my wrists.
So what am I going to do? Oh, God. What am I going to do?
20. It's been 2 weeks since I last took this notebook out from under the basement tile and wrote in it. Twice I've heard the mail slot clack on Thursdays during As the World Turns and gone out into the hall to get my money. I've gone to 4 movies, all in the afternoon. Twice I've ground up money in the kitchen pig and thrown my loose change down the storm drain, hiding what I was doing behind the blue plastic recycling basket when I put it down on the curb. One day I went down to News Plus, thinking I'd get a copy of Variations or Forum. There was a headline on the front of the dispatch that, once again, took away any sexy feelings I might have had. "Pope dies of heart attack on peace mission," it said. Did I do it? Nah, the story said he died in Asia, and I've been sticking to the American Northwest these last few weeks. But I could have been the one. If I'd been nosing around in Pakistan last week, I very likely would have been the one. 2 weeks of living in a nightmare. Then, this morning, there was something in the mail. Not a letter. I've only gotten 3 or 4 of those, all from Pug, and now he's stopped writing, and I miss him so much. But a Kmart advertising circular. It flopped open just as I was putting it into the trash, and something fluttered out. A note printed in block letters. "Do you want out?" it read. "If yes, send message, 'Don't stand so close to me,' is best police song." My heart was beating hard and fast, the way it did on the day I came into my house and saw the Rembrandt print over the sofa where the velvet clowns had been. Below the message, someone had drawn a fowder. It was harmless just sitting there all by itself, but looking at it still made all the spit in my mouth dry up. It was a real message. The fowder proved it, but who had it come from? And how did the sender know about me? I went into the study walking slowly with my head down, thinking. A message tucked into an advertising circular. Hand-printed and tucked into an advertising circular. That meant someone close. Someone in town. I turned on my computer and modem. I called the Columbia City Public Library, where you can surf cheap and in relative anonymity. Anything I sent would go through TransCorp in Chicago, but that wasn't going to matter. They weren't going to suspect a thing, not if I was careful. And of course, if there was anybody there. There was. My computer connected with the library's computer and a menu flashed on my screen. Just for a moment, something else flashed on my screen as well. A smim. In the lower right-hand corner, just a flicker. I sent the message about the best police song and added a little touch of my own down in the dead folks' nook. A sankophyte. I could write more. Things have started to happen, and I believe that soon they'll be happening fast. But I don't think it would be safe. Up to now, I've just talked about myself. If I went any further, I'd have to talk about other people. But there are 2 more things I want to say. First, that I'm sorry for what I've done, for what I did to Skipper, even. I'd take it back if I could. I didn't know what I was doing. I know that's a piss-poor excuse, but it's the only one I have. Second, I've got it in mind to write 1 more special letter, the most special of all. I have Mr. Sharpton's email address, and I have something even better. A memory of how he stroked his lucky tie as we sat in his big, expensive Mercedes. The loving way he ran his palm over those silk swords. So you see, I know just enough about him. I know just what to add to his letter, how to make it eventual. I can close my eyes and see 1 word floating there in the darkness behind my lids. Floating there like black fire, deadly as an arrow fired into the brain. And it's the only word that matters. Excalibur.
shook our senses with the shining. He caressed our fears with caring. And now, he beckons sinister forces from the depths of our psyche with bag of bone. Ladies and gentlemen, reading his short story, LT's Theory of Pets, will you please welcome Stephen King.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you all for coming, and I think we'll have a pretty good time for people who are all going to die someday. And I'm going to read you this story, but before I do, I just want to remind you of a couple of things. First is, we're all in here together now, and we're fairly safe, but later on you'll have to go to your cars. And it will be dark. And there are mad people in the city, we know that. It's just a fact of life, and I don't want to scare you unduly, but there could be somebody in your back seat. It's not likely, but you'll admit that it is possible, and you wouldn't want to be driving home and look in your rearview mirror and see somebody there, would you? So check. What does it hurt? It doesn't hurt to check. The other thing is, I'd like you to take a moment now, before I begin reading this story, to ask yourself one question. Did I leave the shower curtain open or closed? And if you feel that you left the shower curtain open and it's closed when you get back, I suggest you get out of your place in a hurry. Again, I don't want to scare you unduly, but these things have to be considered. Muriel Gray is going to present some questions in the second half of this program, if I survive the first half without a cataclysmic heart attack. It's always a possibility. We're always only an inch or two away, aren't we, from whatever's going to happen. I don't want to upset you with that or make you anxious, but it is the fact. She's got a list of questions that we're going to answer some of them. But the first question that I saw on her list is horror all you write? And the answer, of course, is not on purpose. It's just that things seem to drift that way after a while. And I had an idea for a story. This goes back about a year. About people and their pets. Somebody had said something to me, you know, ideas start when you least expect them. Somebody said, have you ever noticed that people's pets grow to be like them as time goes by? And it occurred to me that yes, that was true. People with sweet natures had sweet natured pets, and people with sort of bad tempers generally had dogs. You had to mind your ankles. So I started to have an idea for a story about a marriage that was sort of in trouble and people who bought each other pets. And I thought to myself, if the pets started to like the wrong member of this partnership, that would be sort of funny. You'd be surprised how many of my stories start with the idea of that would be sort of funny. I set out to write a funny story that would be rather rude. If rude language offends you, I suggest you cover your ears. I set out to write a story that I thought would be funny. It sort of drifted toward this other area, toward the end. So this is called LT's Theory of Pets. Hasn't been published in Great Britain yet, and depending on your reaction, may never be published in Great Britain. LT's Theory of Pets. My friend, LT, hardly ever talks about how his wife disappeared or how she's probably dead, just another victim of the Axeman. But he likes to tell the story of how she walked out on him. He does it with just the right roll of the eyes, as if to say, she fooled me, boys, right good and proper. He'll sometimes tell the story to a bunch of men sitting on one of the loading docks behind the plant and eating their lunches, him eating his lunch too, the one he fixed himself. No Lulu Bell back at home to do it for him these days. They usually laugh when he tells the story, which always ends with LT's theory of pets. Hell, I usually laugh. It's a funny story, even if you do know how it turned out. And not that any of us do. Not completely. I punched out at 4, just like usual, LT will say, then went down to Deb's den for a couple of beers, just like most days. Had a game of pinball, then went home. That was when things stopped being just like usual. When a person gets up in the morning, he doesn't have the slightest idea how much may have changed in his life by the time he lays his head down again that night. Ye know not the hour or the day, the Bible says. I believe that particular verse is about dying, but it fits everything else, boys. Everything else in the world. You just never know when you're going to bust a fiddle string. When I turn into the driveway, I see the garage doors open and the little Subaru she brought to the marriage is gone, but that doesn't strike me as immediately peculiar. She was always driving off someplace to a yard sale or someplace and leaving the goddamn garage door open. I'd tell her, Lulu, if you keep doing that long enough, somebody will eventually take advantage of it, come in and take a rake or a bag of peat moss or maybe even the power mower. Hell, even a Seventh-day Adventist fresh out of college and doing his merit badge rounds will steal if you put enough temptation in his way. And that's the worst kind of person to tempt because they feel it more than the rest of us. Anyway, she'd say, I'll do better, LT. Try anyway. I really will, honey. And she did do better, just backslid from time to time like any ordinary sinner. I park off to the side so she'll be able to get her car in when she comes back from wherever, but I close the garage door. Then I go in by way of the kitchen. I check the mailbox, but it's empty, the mail inside on the counter, so she must have left after 11 because he don't come till at least then, the mailman, I mean. Well, Lucy's right there by the door, crying in that way Siamese have. I like that cry. Think it's kind of cute. But Lulu always hated it, maybe because it sounds like a baby's cry, and she didn't want anything to do with babies. What would I want with a rug monkey, she'd say. Lucy being at the door wasn't anything out of the ordinary either. That cat loved my ass. Still does. She's 2 years old now. We got her at the start of the last year we were married, right around. Seems impossible to believe Lulu's been gone a year, and we were only together 3 to start with. But Lulu Bell was the type to make an impression on you. Lulu Bell had what I have to call star quality. You know who she reminded me of? Lucille Ball. Now that I think about it, I guess that's why I named the cat Lucy, although I don't remember thinking it at the time. It must have been what you'd call a subconscious association. She'd come into a room, Lulu Bell, I mean, not the cat, and just light it up somehow. A person like that, when they're gone, you can hardly believe it. You keep expecting them to come back. Meanwhile, there's the cat. Her name was Lucy to start with, but Lulu Bell hated the way she acted so much that she started to call her Screw Lucy, and it kind of stuck. Lucy wasn't nuts, though. She only wanted to be loved. Wanted to be loved more than any other pet I've ever had in my life, and I've had quite a few. Anyway, I come into the house and pick up the cat and pet her a little, and she climbs up onto my shoulder and sits there purring and talking her Siamese talk. I check the mail on the counter, put the bills in the basket, then go over to the fridge to get Lucy something to eat. I always keep a working can of cat food in there with a piece of tinfoil over the top. Saves having Lucy get excited and digging her claws into my shoulder when she hears the can opener. Cats are smart, you know. Much smarter than dogs. They are different in other ways, too. It might be the biggest division in the world isn't men and women, but folks who like cats and folks who like dogs. Did any of you pork packers ever think of that? Lulu bitched like hell about having an open can of cat food in the fridge, even one with a piece of foil over the top, said it made everything in there taste like old tuna, but I wouldn't give in on that one. Mm-mm. On most stuff, I did it her way, but that cat food business was one of the few places where I really stood up for my rights. Didn't have anything to do with the cat food anyway. It had to do with a cat. She just didn't like Lucy, that was all. Lucy was her cat, but she didn't like it. Anyway, I go over to the fridge, and I see there's a note on it, stuck there with one of the vegetable magnets. It's from Lulu Bell. Best I can remember, it goes like this. Dear LT, I am leaving you, honey. Unless you come home early, I will be long gone by the time you get this note. I don't think you will get home early. You never have got home early in all the time we've been married. But at least I know you'll get this almost as soon as you get in the door, because the first thing you always do when you get home isn't to come see me and say, hi, sweet girl, I'm home, and give me a kiss, but go to the fridge and get whatever's left of that last nasty can of Kahlo you put in there and feed Screw Lucy. So at least I know you just won't go upstairs and get shocked when you see my Elvis Last Supper picture is gone and my half of the closet is mostly empty and think we had a burglar who likes ladies' dresses, unlike some who only care what is under them. I get irritated with you sometime, honey, but I still think you're sweet and kind and nice, and you will always be my little maple duff and sugar dumpling, no matter where our paths may lead. It's just that I have decided I was never cut out to be a spam packer's wife. I don't mean that in any conceited way either. I even called the psychic hotline last week as I struggled with this decision, lying awake night after night and listening to you snore. Boy, do you have a snore on you. I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but you do. And I was given this message: a broken spoon may become a fork. I didn't understand that at first, but I didn't give up on it. I may not be smart like some people, and like some people who think they are, but I work at things. The best mill grinds slow but exceedingly fine, my mother used to say, and I ground away at this like a pepper mill in a Chinese restaurant, thinking late at night while you snored and no doubt dreamed of how many pork snouts you could get in one can of Spam. And it came to me, that saying about how a broken spoon can become a fork is a beautiful thing to behold, because a fork has tines, and those tines may have to separate, like you and me must now have to separate, but still, they have the same handle. So do we. We are both human beings, LT, capable of loving and respecting one another. Look at the fights we have had about Frank and Screw Lucy, and still we mostly manage to get along. Yet the time has now come for me to seek my fortune along different lines from yours, and to poke into the great roast of life with different points from yours. Besides, I miss my mother. Now, I can't say for sure how much, if any of this stuff was really in the note LT found on his fridge. It doesn't seem entirely likely, I must admit. But the men listening to his story would be rolling in the aisles by this point, or around the loading dock at least. And it did sound like Lulu Bell. That I can testify to. Please do not try to follow me, LT. And although I'll be at my mother's, and I know you have that number, I would appreciate you not calling, but waiting for me to call you. In time I will. But in the meantime, I have a lot of thinking to do, and although I have gotten a fair way with it, I'm not out of the fog yet. I suppose I will be asking you for a divorce eventually, and think it is only fair to tell you so. I have never been one to hold out false hope, believing it's better to tell the truth and smoke out the devil. Please remember that what I do in love, not in hatred and resentment. And please remember what was told to me, and what I now tell to you: a broken spoon may be a fork in disguise. All my love, Lulu Bell Sims. LT would pause there, letting them digest the fact that she had gone back to her maiden name and giving his eyes a few of those patented LT DeWitt rolls. Then he'd tell them about the P.S. that she tacked on the note. I have taken Frank with me and left Screw Lucy for you. I thought this would probably be the way you'd want it. Love, Lulu. If the DeWitt family was a fork, Screw Lucy and Frank were the other two tines on it. If there wasn't a fork, and speaking for myself, I've always felt marriage was more like a knife, the dangerous kind with two sharp edges. Screw Lucy and Frank could still be said to sum up everything that went wrong with the marriage of LT and Lulu Bell. Because, think of it, although Lulu Bell bought Frank for LT's first wedding anniversary, and LT bought Lucy, soon to be Screw Lucy, for Lulu Bell, second wedding anniversary, they each wound up with the other one's pet when Lulu walked out of the marriage. She got me that dog because I like the one on Frasier, LT would say. That kind of dog's a terrier, but I don't remember now what they call that kind. A Jack something. Jack Spratt? Jack Robinson? Jack Shit? You know how a thing like that gets on the tip of your tongue? Somebody would tell him that Frasier's dog was a Jack Russell Terrier, and LT would nod emphatically. That's right, he'd exclaim. Sure, exactly. That's what Frank was, all right, a Jack Russell Terrier. But you want to know the cold, hard truth? An hour from now, that one slipped away from me again. It'll be there in my brain, but like something behind a rock. An hour from now, I'm going to be saying to myself, what did that guy say Frank was? A Jack Handle Terrier? A Jack Rabbit Terrier? That's close. I know it's close. And so on. Why? I think it's because I just hated that little fuck so much. That barking rat. That fur-covered shit machine. I hated it from the first time I laid eyes on it. There. It's out of me, and I'm glad. And do you know what? Frank felt the same about me. That's right. It was hate at first sight. You know how some men train their dog to bring them their slippers? Frank wouldn't bring me my slippers, but he'd puke in them. Yes. The first time he did it, I stuck my foot right into it. It was like sticking your foot into a warm tapioca with extra big lumps in it. Although I didn't see him, my theory is that he waited outside the bedroom door until he saw me coming. Fucking lurked outside the bedroom door. Then went in, unloaded in my right slipper, and then hid under the bed to watch the fun. I deduced that on the basis of how the puke was still warm. Fucking dog. Man's best friend, my ass. I wanted to take it to the pound after that. Had the leash out and everything, but Lulu threw an absolute fit. You would have thought she'd come into the kitchen and caught me trying to give the dog a drain cleaner enema. If you take Frank to the pound, you might as well take me to the pound, she says, starting to cry. That's all you think of him, and that's all you think of me. Honey, all we are is nuisances you'd like to be rid of. That is the cold, hard truth. I mean, all my bleeding piles, on and on. He puked in my slipper, I says. The dog puked in his slipper, so off with his head, she says. Oh, sugar pie, if you could only hear yourself. Hey, I say, try sticking your bare foot into a slipper filled with dog puke and see how you like it. Getting mad by then, you know. Except, getting mad at Lulu never did any good. Most times, if you had the king, she had the ace. If you had the ace, she had a trump. Also, the woman would fucking escalate. If something happened and I got irritated, she'd get pissed. If I got pissed, she'd get mad. If I got mad, she'd go fucking Red Alert DEFCON 1 and empty the missile silos. I'm talking scorched earth here. Mostly it wasn't worth it, except almost every time we'd get into a fight, I'd forget that. She'd go, oh dear, Maple Duff stuck his widow footy in a widow spit up. I tried to get in there, tell her that wasn't right. Spit up is like drool. Spit up doesn't have these big fucking chunks in it. But she won't let me get a word in. By then, she's really in the passing lane. She's